I want to tell you about a podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Urtube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. The latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. As a parent myself of a child who's had an IEP since kindergarten and he's now a 10th grader, I know how confusing, overwhelming, frustrating, sometimes daunting the whole process can be. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains called The Difference Between IEPs and 504 Plans. And what I love about it is how easily Juliana explains everything. She answers common questions that probably every parent or caregiver has. She dispels myths and is concise and to the point. To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. And there's a direct link in the show notes if you need it. This is Your Kick-Ass Life Podcast, episode number R3 with guest Laura McCowan. All links and resources you hear on this podcast can be found by going to yourkickasslife.com/R3.
This is the Your Kick-Ass Life Podcast with Andrea Owen, a no BS guide to self-help and badassery. Because ladies, let's face it, life's too short for it to not kick ass. And here's your host, the girl who serves it up straight with a side of crazy, Andrea Owen.
Hey there, ass kickers. Welcome to another episode of the special edition I'm rolling out on recovery. I hope you have enjoyed the last few episodes. Well, actually, it's only been a couple. The last couple of episodes, I should say, as much as I have enjoyed sending them out to you. This has been a labor of love, and I just am ecstatic to be able to talk about something that's so very important to me that I don't really talk about a whole lot on my regularly scheduled podcast. And just a couple of things about it. First, if you have any questions that you specifically would like me to ask the guests or that you would like me to address, simply shoot us an email at support@yourkickasslife.com and let us know. I am rolling out 10 of these total. This is the third one. And I will be doing another 10 in 2017, probably around the summer. So if I don't get to your question by the end of the series, please send it anyway, because I will be rolling out a whole nother series where I would love to be able to specifically answer your questions. Also, these episodes are a little bit longer than my regular episodes. And the reason for that is that I wanted my guests to be able to tell their stories, because I wanted you to specifically hear the progression of alcoholism in these stories. I didn't want it to be just the ending of what happened and, you know, tell people like, you only have 5 minutes to tell your story because we need to get on to other things. I wanted you to hear the whole thing, because the progression is what's important. We don't just wake up one day at our own rock bottom and decide, okay, it's done. It's definitely a progression. If you don't want to miss any of these particular episodes come out on Tuesdays, but if you don't want to miss them, especially if you don't want to miss the show notes, they can be delivered to your inbox. These particular episodes tend to have a lot of resources. And the more I talk to the guests, the more resources I get, and I don't want you to miss them. So if you're not already on my email list, you can simply text the word kickass, that's just all one word, to 444-999. That's the word kickass to 444-999. And you'll also get, as a bonus, my free ebook and audio that's titled How the Shit Talking in Your Head is Making You Crazy and 3 Ways to Change It. And if for some reason you're already signed up, but you're not getting my emails, especially if you have Gmail, check your promotions folder and they're probably hiding in there. Or I might go to your spam. Wah, wah. So you might want to check over there. Let me now tell you a little bit about today's guest. Laura McCowan is a mama, a writer, a light seeker, and a recovery warrior. In 2016, she traded in her corporate executive job to teach yoga and write full-time and is a regular contributor to The Huffington Post, ExoJane, Scary Mommy, and Elephant Journal, among others. She's the co-host of Home Podcast, a show that explores the big questions of life through the lens of addiction recovery. Laura lives on the North Shore of Boston with her daughter and is writing her first book, a memoir. I'm so excited for you to meet Laura. She is just really, really amazing. And without further ado, here she is.
Hello, Ass Kickers. Welcome to another edition of the recovery series of the Your Kick-Ass Life podcast. And I am here with Laura McCowan, someone I have been fantasizing about being my friend. I already told her.
And we're friends now.
We are. I didn't have to demand it. Thank you for agreeing.
Anytime.
And yeah, this is the third installment of this podcast. The show notes are over at yourkickasslife.com/R3. I cannot wait for you to meet her. So let's jump right in, Laura, and let's let's just, you know, dive right into the deep end. Like I was saying, that's what I like to do. Let's start with your story. So more specifically, what we're talking about on this series is we're interested in what was your relationship with alcohol before, and tell us when you realized it was time to quit and make a change.
Okay. So my relationship with alcohol started youngish. I was a teenager, and it definitely wasn't one of those things for me. A lot of people tell stories about, you know, the first time they drank, the lights came on and it was like they found the answer to, you know, all of their insecurities and issues. And for me, it wasn't really like that, but I did notice that it allowed me to be things that I wasn't pretty quickly. It allowed me to particularly like connect with the boys. It allowed me to not be anxious. It allowed me to kind of do whatever I want. I was a pretty good girl. I was kind of afraid of guys, but I wanted their attention so badly. And it felt like a way in, right? It smoothed things out for me. And so I started drinking. I was raised in a family where drinking was really common. It wasn't that it was, you know, in hindsight, I can see that it was very overboard, but it wasn't outwardly like that. It was just around.
It was like other families, probably.
All the time. Yeah, it was just, it was there. It was just always there. And I thought that's what people did. I thought that's what people did all the time, you know, as a matter of course, of just being together socially. Mm-hmm. So I never really thought much of it. When I do have, you know, one story that I always tell where I remember there being a shift, and I think it's important because it's what I sort of chased for the next 20 years. But when I was 17, I graduated from high school. I was younger, on the younger side, and I had my high school graduation party at my family's restaurant. We owned a restaurant, and at that point, you know, it was okay for me to drink because I was graduating from high school, and so we were all drinking openly, and that was awesome. I thought it was like the greatest thing ever. Mm-hmm. You know, I can like pour myself a drink, and it was okay with everyone. And you know, this was like in the middle of the day. I was really, really thin at that point. I had developed a really bad eating disorder at the end of high school. I was horribly insecure and I was scared. I didn't know what was coming. And I knew the amount of calories in toothpaste. I was exercising addictively. And alcohol, though, was a thing that allowed me to both feel, because anyone, I'm assuming your audience is a lot of women and probably a lot of women that have had eating disorders. And I went numb. I mean, it made me numb. That was kind of the desired effect. I didn't know that, but that's what it was doing. And alcohol allowed me to feel, and it also numbed me. It was like a way that and it also allowed me to eat. I wouldn't let myself eat otherwise, but if I was drinking, I could eat. So, you know, just to paint the picture of me standing there at this bar at my family's restaurant, I had this little black tank top on, and I had this whole, you know, next chapter of my life out in front of me, going to college and leaving, and my family was in a bunch of turmoil. And I remember pouring my third really large Bacardi Limon in Diet Coke, because that's how I rolled then. And I remember feeling this wave of power come over me. I was drunk. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling like it was like a feeling of love.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, if I can stay like this, everything's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. To that.
So, yeah.
If I can hold on to this, everything's going to be fine.
If I just stay this way, everything's going to be okay. So I chased that. I really did chase it. And it was hidden to me in a way. I knew that I had this sort of lust and hunger for alcohol that it didn't seem like other people had all through college, all through my 20s. But I also surrounded myself with people who drank a lot. I went to a super big partying school. I started working in marketing and advertising. And so I was never, unless you really, really knew me, I didn't stand out much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of signs along the way. There were a lot of, I knew I had a lot of shame. I had a lot of anxiety and shame when I woke up in the morning after drinking, because I always blacked out, even if it was just, you know, moments or whatever. I blacked out and I felt so much anxiety and shame around it. And I didn't feel like other people felt that way. But, you know, I just kept piling it on. You just kept piling it on. And amidst all this, I was like creating a life. Like, I had always been super social. I had, you know, I got jobs and I did well at them. And I developed a whole exterior persona through the course of my 20s that, you know, kind of hid the thing that was going on in the background. Even to me, it mm-hmm. hid it even to me. So I met my husband, the guy who would be my husband, when I was about 27. And I remember my friends saying to me, I'm so relieved that Ryan is in your life now because we don't have to take care of you anymore. And I thought, like, we all laughed, you know, we laughed because it was true, but it wasn't funny. You know, it
Did
wasn't
they mean
fun.
Like take care of you in general or take care of you when
no,
you all went out?
When I'm drinking.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was always that girl. I had to be, someone always had to take care of me mm-hmm. and it was a known thing. So my relationship with alcohol at that time, because I was like fell in love and I was distracted and that became, I guess, the object of my mm-hmm. energy, it tamped down. And there were lots of periods of time in my life like that. So, you know, to me, it just kept it further from my consciousness that this was a thing, that this was an issue.
Well, too, I think in your 20s, like, that's kind of what a lot of us did.
Oh, for sure.
It's just sort of the culture.
And I hung out with people who went after it. Right. I mean, I loved the fact that we went out on Tuesday nights until 2 a.m. and we mm-hmm. didn't think anything of it. And that's just what we did. I mean, I love the fact that we drank more after college than we did in college. I thought that was like the greatest thing ever. And I made friends who day drank and that was the greatest thing ever. And every activity that we, you know, every
revolved
activity that
booze.
We created was mm-hmm. revolved heavily around drinking. And I loved it. I honestly, you know, I'm sure you've heard this progression before, but the short version of my story would be something like some fun and some problems, and then no fun, all problems.
And that's how trying to have fun.
Yes. Hey, wishing it was still fun. Convincing myself that it was still fun.
Yeah.
So that would be the short version. But mm-hmm. so I met my husband and, you know, that moved pretty quickly. And there are two things that were really important in sort of how this progressed. One was I pretty quickly realized after I got married that I didn't want to be married. And I had no idea what to do with that. And I drank at it.
Mm-hmm.
I drank to know it, drank to not know it. I drank to feel it, I drank to not feel it. And I, as you know, from being married, I mean, all your stuff comes up in relationships. You can't avoid it. I had no real coping skills or communication skills. So I drank, you know, I drank at it. I didn't know how to deal with what I felt and the reality that I had created. So I just started to blow it up.
Mm-hmm. Just set it on fire.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Little fire by little fire. And then sometimes very big fires. And the drinking was central to that. You know, that's where I see if you like kind of track my drinking right after I got married, there was a big uptick in the problem area. And then I got pregnant with our daughter and I was not happy about that. I was felt really trapped. I didn't want to even be married. And, yet I loved this man. I mean, I still love him, but, you know, so it was like an extra mind fuck. Mm-hmm. And I got pregnant and I, you know, thought about all the reasons I didn't want to have this baby, but we had her. And when we had my daughter, that's when it really, the second time it really changed again, because
did you go back to work or did you stay home with her?
Both. It would take a whole other podcast or two to talk about how insane the circumstances of our life was that time. It was 2010, just to put it in context.
Oh, okay. Yes, I remember.
So yeah. That's kind of all, you know, like a lot of us need to say. Neither of us had jobs.
Yep.
I had just been let go of mine. He just graduated from law school and got his MBA and couldn't find a job.
For anyone listening that maybe isn't from the United States, 2010 was when we were just coming out of a very, very bad recession.
Yes. And it was real. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was real. It was something that you and I hadn't experienced in our...
Not in our lifetime.
Lifetime. And it was a big blow to us. So there was that. There was all kinds of family stuff. And I got horrible, horrible postpartum depression / anxiety. And I didn't know that, though. Like, it's funny how, and I'm sure you relate to this, too, even those of us who are, like, self-help people, who are seekers, we kind of know the concept of these things that people go through and we're attracted to, like, understanding them. But even though I had just, like, I had learned everything I could about postpartum depression anxiety, I didn't even know I was in it when it was happening. I knew I was in it when I couldn't eat anymore and I couldn't function on a day-to-day basis. And I was, like, cutting myself with safety pins just to figure out what was happening, you know, just to do something. Like, I lost my mind. Mm-hmm. The drinking at that point, that's when it really stopped working for me. This thing that had always been like a release, it just made it so much worse. It made my anxiety so much worse. But yet I kept doing it. You know, it was like pouring gasoline on my anxiety, but I didn't know what else to do. And I loved drinking. Mm-hmm. It was like, how do I let this thing go? So that was the sort of second turn. And then the third turn was when my husband and I separated, which was a few years later after a long, bumpy road. And you know, the wheels just really came off because no one was watching me anymore. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of the thing that I wanted. I wanted to do what I wanted and drink the way I wanted and sleep with whoever I wanted. And, you know, I thought I wanted this and I did. I wanted to not be married anymore, but I was so untethered and the drinking got really scary. So at that point it got to be, I really didn't know what was going to happen to me when I drank. I didn't know if, you know, I would have to think through what is the worst possible thing that could happen to you tonight if you start drinking. And are you willing to pay the price for mm-hmm. that? Are you willing to pay the price for potentially sleeping with that person that you know is going to be out? Are you willing to pay the price with ending up in Somerville at a drug dealer's house because you know that drugs are going to be available? You know, that's the kind of sort of twisted thought process I would have. And a lot of times I was willing, if I even had the cognizance to make the choice. Yeah. So most of the time I didn't. And a lot of the time I didn't, you know, it took me a while to get to the point of realizing that I really just didn't have a choice anymore.
Yeah.
It could go any direction. I could have a drink and maybe I would make it home and I would be fine. And I would, you know, definitely drink more at home, but no quote unquote damage done. But other times I didn't know, you know, I had a lot of jackpots. I got a DUI. That was horrific. Mm-hmm. I totaled my car not shortly thereafter. My sort of turning point, which is the second part of your question, you know, when did I realize I had to stop, is one instance that really slammed me against the wall was I took my daughter to my brother's wedding in Colorado, and I left her in a hotel room the night of the wedding alone because I went back out in a blackout to the bar and I woke up in someone else's room. Two texts from my family saying, where are you? You know, your daughter is with us. She, by the grace of God, found my mother in a hotel of thousands of people, ended up finding my mother. And that was the moment where I had to do something because now it was public. I mean, everybody, you know, my whole family was there and they knew, and they weren't going to, you know, watch me take my daughter down. And, and I was so pissed. I was horrified that I had done that to my daughter, but I was so mad that I had been caught.
Oh, really?
Oh my God.
So you don't think you were ready? Like, had you up to that point thought, like, I wonder if I should think about getting help?
Hundreds of times.
Okay.
I hadn't thought so far as to say, I wonder if I should get help. No, because that would have been like a real admission.
Uh-huh.
I can trace back to, you know, that time when I was 17 of thinking this isn't right. But I didn't think it was alcohol that was, I always thought it was something else.
Okay. Gotcha.
But this was so in my face and so, I don't even need to explain it. That was the first time, you know, someone said to me, you have to do something about this. Where I couldn't squirm out of it. I mean, my ex-husband had said that to me many times and a couple other people had too. But like the outsides were pretty good still.
Trying to find the perfect gift for someone special in your life, maybe for Mother's Day, but feeling overwhelmed? Finding a unique gift that they'll love, that's personal and that they won't already have, can be the ultimate challenge. That's why I'm so excited I've discovered Songfinch. It's an amazing, thoughtful gift, and it's easy and fun to make. Songfinch lets you create an original radio-quality song inspired by your own life and the people you love. It's completely unique, personal, and lasts forever. I had Songfinch make me a song about my dad, which was a gift to myself. This was such a personal song for me, and I was a little skeptical the artist could capture the emotion I wanted. But during the process, they have you share some personal details about your relationship with the person you're creating the song for. Then a Songfinch musician of your choice, you get to pick based on samples they have, will write, record, and produce your original song in just 4 to 7 days. I love my song so much. I was so emotional when I listened to it. I had no changes. It's perfect. Whether your song is for Father's Day, an upcoming graduation, wedding, or anniversary, or even just a gift to show your loved one how much you care, start your song now to lock in one of Songfinch's top artists. For a limited time, Songfinch is letting our listeners upload their song to Spotify for free, so you and the lucky person you gift it to can listen to it anywhere, anytime. Go to songfinch.com/noise and start your song. After you purchase, you'll be prompted to add Spotify streaming for your original song for free, a $50 value. Again, my URL is songfinch.com/noise. Don't forget to share your song with us too. songfinch.com/noise. There's definitely been times in my life where my paycheck ran out before I got paid again, and I wish I could have accessed my next paycheck a few days before I was due to get it. Well, what if I told you that can happen with Earnin? Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. You can use Earnin for anything you need to, therapy visits, rent, or even extra self-help books. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Noise under podcast when you sign up. It really helps the show. Noise under podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
There's a lot of evidence that I could point to say, it's fine. You know, this part's fine. This part of my life's fine. I'm going through a hard time. And, you know, I was.
Stressed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going through a divorce. I'm X, Y, Z. So that was in July of 2013. And then I went to my first 12-step meeting shortly thereafter, and I didn't accept it. I didn't start to my sober date. My last day one is September 28, 2014. So over a year later is when I put it down for good. And in that time, you know, so much happened, but I think the difference, you know, what really caused me to turn around, or I think that the difference was I was so afraid of not changing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what was going to happen if I kept drinking.
Yeah.
I didn't know what was going to happen if I didn't. And that's terrifying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's, you know, potentially a lot better, like it's still unknown. And I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was so afraid of not changing. I couldn't imagine getting to the end of my life. It just didn't compute for me to get to the end of my life and say, no, I died of alcoholism, or I died of drinking, or I let my daughter be a motherless kid, or any of those things. I just knew, even though I was in so much pain and I was so broken, I knew I had a big, big light inside of me still. And in that time, I had started writing, which is what I had wanted to do my whole life. And I kind of wrote my way out of it. So I don't know what the magic thing was about September 28th. Honestly, I think it's a combination of all of many factors. But yeah, that was my last day.
Wow. So there's such a great story too. Thanks for sharing it. And you're just being so candid and honest. And there's a couple things I wanted to say. And the first thing I want to point out for anyone listening is that I love that you told us, and obviously it was kind of the brief version, the 15-minute version of from when you were a teenager up until, you know, you were in your 30s. And I think that for anyone listening who's still drinking and thinking about getting sober, or who's in the beginning stages of recovery, or not even, who's been in recovery for a while, is that you might keep hearing what we say is that it's progressive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you didn't wake up one day getting shit-faced and leaving your daughter in a hotel room. Like, it was definitely something like that went downhill. I think too is, I don't know if it was like this for you, but my own progression scared the shit out of me. Like, how fast it was happening.
Oh, totally. It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And for me, I had some like lucid moments of thinking, if it's going this fast and it's this bad, what's it going to be like in 5 years? What's it going to be like in 10 years? Because I kept telling myself, like, I would hear stories like yours and I'd be like, well, I never had a DUI.
Totally.
I've never done that.
I
remember seeing Ellie Schoenberg, who's actually now a friend of mine. This was back when Oprah still had her regular daytime show. It was on women alcoholics, and they were profiling Ellie at home. And she was talking about how she used to hide bottles of Chardonnay in the dryer and in the laundry room. And I was like,
and you're like, well, that's
fucked up. That's an alcoholic, right? Let's just
yeah.
Or that show Intervention, like, holy hot mess. Like, that was a way for me to keep drinking. That was a way for me to convince myself that that was not me. But the thing that scared me was knowing how fast I was moving down that train. And that I knew deep down, as much as I didn't want to admit it, that I was going to end up that way.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good, or it's not good. It's just, I don't know that I had that. I had the sense of being on this train that was going faster and faster and faster and faster. But yes, it's so crazy how fast and how much it progresses and how tricky that is to our minds, you know, because we can go back to not too long ago, you know, and think it was like this. It was, it looked like this, you know, I want that back. And it was so heartbreaking, truly heartbreaking. And filled me with a lot of grief. And that's something I don't think we talk about a lot, is to leave this life behind, to leave this idea of alcohol and what a drinking life meant and all the connections it made for me and all that, all the things I yoked to drinking, to leave it behind.
Right. Yeah. I remember thinking, like, I could not imagine Andrea sober. Like, and it scared me. I was like, who am I without drinking? Like, I drink.
Right.
That's what I
drink.
I do.
Yes.
I am the fun one. I mean, to an extent.
Right.
His husband used to say, like, you're one shot of Patron away from just a disaster. Like, and we just never knew when it was going to happen, and it turned on a dime. But, and it always did turn. But I'm glad that you used that word grief, because I think it is something that we don't talk about enough. And I think that for me, it was too, it was leaving behind my 20s and this life of, you know, not having responsibilities, and just, it was a life of fun, and go walking into a new chapter of marriage and being a grown up. And it was scary, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know how to be a mom, and I didn't love being a stay at home mom, and I thought I should, and like all of this stuff happening, and I didn't know how to handle it. And I was like you, I didn't have any coping skills to deal with life. I didn't have any communication skills. I didn't know, you know, intimacy was, whether it was with friends or with my partner, was like one of those things. I always say, like, it was that thing that I craved the most, but it was the thing I was the most afraid of.
Yeah.
So I drank.
which is why you drink. Right. And it's, and then it just magically becomes accessible.
Easier. I mean, mm-hmm.
It becomes easier just like that. I know you just made me think of something that just on the progression note, towards the end, I would ride to work in my car that I loved that I ended up totaling. I would ride to work. The mornings were always awful. At that point, I was a daily drinker, not drinking during the day, but I drink every night. I drink mm-hmm. wine. And the mornings were awful and filled with anxiety and adrenaline. And it was just like, how can I, you know, how do I get into this day? And so I had this routine, you know, I would just like go. And I remember like being in my car, I'd be in this crazy traffic and putting on my mascara in the car mm-hmm. and looking at my eyes, and they were bloodshot and also started to get yellow. And just looking at my reflection, like my own eyes, and thinking, this is what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. This is what it looks like.
It's happening to me.
Mm-hmm. It's happening to me, right?
Yeah, all of these, it's interesting. I think like every person in recovery I've ever talked to has said that they had these like small moments of mm-hmm. Glenn Doyle Melton would call them invitations, you know, to kind of stop the madness. I'm a kind of a believer that we all have different pain tolerances and some of us can't take that much. And I don't know, maybe I'm someone that can't take that much. Like I got out, I think, fairly quickly because I was definitely on that road to hiding bottles and getting a DUI. And I think I just escaped it because I just decided. And I know because I love the podcast you have with you and Holly, who's going to be on next week as well. We'll link to the show notes, everybody. It's the Home Podcast. If you're interested in this, then you would love their podcast. But it was a couple of months back, you shared a story about when you were drinking that something happened with your daughter. Mm-hmm. It was like that you had gone to a parade or something. Can you share that story with us? Because it was
yeah, that's the story. This isn't the parade story. I won't tell that one, but this is, I know which one you're talking about.
There was like vomit and boots involved.
it was a shame episode. So there was lots of rough stories, but this is the one I know that you're talking about. And it's one that people have responded to the most. So towards the very end of my drinking, I was in my house. This is, you know, by the way, like once you start going, especially to recovery meetings, it kind of ruins your drinking. I mean, I knew there was no part of me that knew that thought drinking was okay for me anymore. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't stop yet. Mm-hmm. I could stop for periods of time, but I couldn't stay stopped. And so every time I drank, it was really dark. Mm-hmm. And this was a night, it was like a regular Wednesday night or something, middle of the week. I had my daughter. I had put her to bed and I had bought wine. I'm sure I had started drinking before she went to bed because I never waited, but started drinking and I had drank like a bottle and I went back out and got another one down the street and I blacked out and I woke up at like 5 a.m. with that rush of adrenaline and anxiety and panic that are so familiar to me mm-hmm. and is the only thing I need to recall to to remind myself, you know, of the hell, by the way. But I woke up to that upshot of adrenaline, anxiety, and panic. And I walked out because I didn't remember like end of night scene, you know, like what was I doing? And I walked out into my hallway. It was covered in vomit on my white walls. So like red vomit red on my white walls, all down and on the floor. And it was all over my boots, winter boots. This was like in the middle of winter. And I started cleaning it just frantically, you know, like scrubbing at these walls. This was a new house I had moved into. This is like where I wanted to be sober. Mm-hmm. It was another line I had drawn, you know, like I'll do it then, I'll do it then, I'll do it then, I'll do it then, I'll do it when I move. Well, so it was like extra heartbreaking. And I was washing, you know, just taking all the spray cleaner and trying to get it off. And my daughter woke up and she was 5 at the time and just said, Mama, what happened? Like, what are you doing? And I panicked, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know, honey, something happened. You know, something must have fell. And she, you know, grabbed a little cloth and got on her knees and started helping me clean.
Oh my God.
This little 5-year-old and you know, someone must have got in, mommy, and, you know, it's just so strange. And I was just shattered. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of stuff, that's the place where it took me, you know, that place. So that's what the end of it looked like. And, you know, that kind of stuff with my daughter is the worst. It's the worst. It's the hardest. It's the darkest. And it also fills me, you know, every time I talk about something like that, I just become profoundly grateful that it's not where I live anymore. Like, that's not what's happening today. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's not what's happening today. So yeah, that's the story.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I remember when you told that story on your podcast, I was like, oh my God, it reminded me of, you know, my kids were little when I got sober, and I had two attempts at getting sober. My second one was apparently, hopefully, the one that stuck. And but So I got sober in May of 2011, and I had 4 or 5 decent months of recovery. I had a really tough sponsor in AA, and she was very
sometimes
strict.
That's a blessing, right?
Yeah, and I think that, like, where it became difficult for me was that I felt like it was very black or white, and I had to do it right or not at all, according to her standards. And, you know, I can make excuses all day. It absolutely, positively was not her fault. And so, I, you know, I could have spoken up and I didn't. And one day my husband and I got into an argument, and, you know, and not having very good communication skills and a lot of abandonment issues. Mm-hmm. When that happens,
it's a great combo.
It's a great combination for a recovering alcoholic. So with that combination, I panicked and he left. And I'm the type of person, like, I want to talk about everything right now when it happens, when it's happening. He needs time to process, and then he will come back and speak with me. So he left and I panicked, and I'm making up stories about how he's going to divorce me. And, you know, I'm already planning my life as a single mom. And I ended up thinking to myself, like, I didn't want to break my sobriety, you know, because I was all proud of the time that I had. And I thought about, like, oh my God, if I drank, then I'm going to have to go to, you know, go back and, like, tell my sponsor, just shame on me. So, but I had this thought that I remember, like, all I wanted was a buzz. Like, I just wanted to run away from this feeling, this anxiety of this crippling feeling of,
you
know,
just my
life was unraveling, right? Panic. So I thought, well, if I drink some NyQuil, I'm not drinking, technically.
God.
But I might be able to get, like, that sleepy, hazy feeling that I was looking for. So, I mean, in like 5 seconds, I was in the bathroom chugging cherry NyQuil. And I'm standing there in the living room and standing there, like, waiting for it to kick in. And I'm like, this isn't good enough. So then I remember hearing an AA speaker talk about how she used to drink vanilla extract, which I had never done before. Which I had no, it's a true story. Swear to God. Which I had never
You're
done
right.
before.
This isn't like a,
it wasn't pretty. It wasn't like, you know, Oprah offered a Miar martini. And, like, because those were, like, the relapse stories, like, I fantasized about. I'm like, if I ever relapse, it's going to be because I'm at a cocktail party with Oprah.
One of my friends and I joke, if Adam Levine wanted to party and, like, you know, do some drugs with me and drink, I obviously would have to.
I couldn't say no. Yeah. No, this isn't one of those, like, you know.
Okay, so we're at vanilla extract.
So then I think about the vanilla extract and I go to the pantry and there was some in there and I took a swig of it and it was disgusting. And I looked at the back of the bottle. So this was in 2011 when this happened and it had expired in 2005.
Oh my God.
And it had, like, sediment all over the bottom of it. Like, I didn't even shake it up. And I was like, at that moment, I was just so disappointed in myself. Like, did I really think that was okay? Apparently I did. Yeah. So at that point I just said, F it. And there was a bottle of wine in my house, which was probably a mistake. And so I opened it up and started drinking it. And then I think that my husband had come home, but I was, you know, like, hiding that I was drinking. And then a couple of hours later, probably not even that long, I was sitting, my kids were jumping on the bed in their room, and I was sitting right outside of the door on the ground. We had this, like, hallway cabinetry thing, and the bottle was in the cabinet. Like, at that point, I didn't even put it in a glass. Like, I just was, like, drinking it straight.
You're like, what's the point?
And so I'm sitting outside of their door. My husband must have been somewhere else and they're jumping on their bed and playing. And so my son was 4 at the time and I'm swigging back the bottle of Chardonnay or Pinot Grigio, one of the two. And he stops jumping and he looks over at me and he goes, kind of with, like, a smile on his face. And he goes, Mommy, what are you doing? And I looked at him.
Oh, that's so funny. I'm sorry.
And I was like, I don't know. And that's all I could, but, like, no, it is funny, but, it, like, at the time I was like, what am I doing?
What am I doing?
I'm drinking wine. Like, I think it was like in the middle of the day too. It was like a Saturday or Sunday from the bottle with my children, because my husband and I got into an argument after drinking vanilla extract and NyQuil because I have anxiety. So yeah, it was just like those, and I had like a flash in my head of, my children are going to end up in therapy regardless, but like, I don't want them to end up in therapy because of this.
Like, at least
I want to like pull this out of the equation. So
I know
that element of shame as a mother, I think that like, we still, there's such a stigma around just alcoholism in general, but I think for mothers,
yeah,
like good moms don't drink too much. Like
that's right.
The standard we have to live up to, but you know, we're still supposed to be social and have play dates and like, you know, and
it's an extra thick level of shame for mothers, which is why I talk about it all the time.
I know. And so do I. Do you ever, I mean, I know you're a couple years in now, but do you still ever have that voice that comes in and tells you that you could moderate, like you could just have one?
No.
No. Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky. I'm really, really lucky. Those aren't the voices, the fucked up voices that I get. There's different ones, you know, like for me, it's more about other stuff, like other ways to escape or constantly wanting an escape from myself.
Yeah.
Whether it's food or men or technology or whatever. But I have no illusion that I can moderate. It sounds like, honestly, moderation sounds like complete hell to me.
Me too.
I never wanted to moderate.
Me neither.
I was always drinking to get
fucked up. Mm-hmm. The way I describe moderation is like, I tell people, okay, so let's say you like ran a marathon this morning, 26 miles, and then came home and did yard work and you hadn't eaten all day. And I'm in the kitchen and I make you your favorite meal and you can smell it. And then I put the plate out in front of you and give you one bite.
Yeah, and that's it. Great. That's
but
great.
But I'm going to keep the rest of it over here so you can still see it and watch everybody else eat it.
Right.
Like, does that sound like fun at all to you?
No. Or even possible? Like, how's that manageable? It's not. You're going to go eat something. Right. Yeah, no, that's a great analogy.
That's how I look at moderation. It doesn't sound fun. It sounds stupid.
Yes, stupid is right.
That's it sounds awful. That's the best word I can come up with.
I
didn't realize, and I hadn't expected to talk about this. So you've mentioned like men and sex and relationships a few times. Did you... Because I was a full-fledged love addict. So do you feel like you had any of those tendencies with men?
I didn't know that I did. And I don't know, for some reason, the like love addict or that like sex addiction, maybe I just don't totally get it. I think it sort of overgeneralizes things. But I definitely, definitely used attention from men and men as another drug as a way to get out of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it paired with the drinking, but it got worse in a way. In some ways, it got worse when I stopped drinking because it plug up one thing and it's like the other, what else do you have? Okay. Right. I'm going to, you know, and it's, I have learned slowly and I'm still very much learning that, you know, that stuff is always there. The general discomfort of being a human being is there until you work on the root issues. And for me, a big root issue, sort of an original wound, is rejection and all my experience of rejection. And so what I started to do, what I see that I have done my whole life really is seek that experience out so that I, in attempt to try to heal it, to heal that original wound of rejection. And, you know, and then I'd act all surprised that, oh my God, I can't believe you're rejecting me. I can't believe this is happening again. And for the first time, you know, I know for the first time, I feel like I'm not doing that. And it's a total miracle. It's like just as much as a miracle is not drinking to me.
Yeah. I can imagine. Yeah. Well, for what it looked like for me, and, you know, Pia Melody wrote Facing Codependency, and she also wrote Facing Love Addiction. And when I read that in 07.
I'll have to look at those.
Yeah. For me, it was such a slap in the face. Like, I felt like she was writing about my life.
Yeah.
And if you've ever struggled with codependence, I mean, all love addicts are codependent. Not all codependents are love addicts. So for me, what it looked like was, I, like you were saying, like, I looked to men and relationships and the chase and the attention as a drug. And my sense of self-worth and self-esteem and level of confidence depended on how much attention I was getting from men. And what's interesting is a couple years ago, it was on my 40th birthday, a bunch of my girlfriends got together and Courtney Webster was there. She was actually on last week. And we were talking about comorbidity in, you know, with alcoholism, you know, a lot of us were had eating disorders and and other ways to try to escape our world. I can't even remember what we were saying, but she was saying something about, I'm totally misquoting how she asked the question, but the way I interpreted it was like, if you could go back, which one would you pick? Like, which poison would you pick? And I was like, immediately I said men. Like, that to me was more potent than booze.
You would like pick to do them both. Being able to do that again?
Yes.
Interesting.
That chase and that euphoria that I, but they were very different. Like, you know, because I don't feel like, I don't know. They were both definitely their own poison, and they kind of like, I got different things from both of them. I think that's why I used them together.
A mixture of them together. I think that's what gets women so much. I mean, men too, I'm sure, but I don't ever hear a story of a woman with alcohol or drug addiction that isn't right alongside a really unhealthy relationship with men and sex.
Yeah.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down.
Or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
I guess I have a hard time totally identifying with it because for me, the man thing didn't look like promiscuity for me, or I was like a good, good girl. I didn't have sex till I was 21. My husband was like the third person I slept with. And I don't even say that was a sense of pride. It was just like, that's just wasn't what I was doing. Uh-huh. Mine was sneakier. I was like, I want you to worship me. Uh-huh. I want you to adore me. I will not sleep with you. And because that would be actual intimacy or something. I don't know. It wasn't until I started drinking a lot that I got to just chase that. And then it was like, oh my God, I have this power.
Yes.
I have this power in my sexuality that I love and I want to use it a lot. And drinking made it possible to use it without having a conscious about it, you know, being conscious about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a podcast episode a while back where I went into a little bit more detail. I can link to that in the show notes, y'all. And where I talk what each of my addictions looked like. And mine wasn't necessarily promiscuity either. I mean, there were definitely times where I said yes when I didn't want to. And for me, it was more like you were saying, it was that power. And it was for like more so than anything, it was that desperate need for connection.
Yes.
And I confused that, like the beginning of a relationship, like the flirting and the chase and just those like first few moments and, you know, weeks into a relationship, I confused that with love and intimacy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what real trust looked like and intimacy. And so I thought that was it. And I was furious if I got rejected, and you know, and it was just,
oh,
it was
like not even just furious, like you wanted to die.
Rage.
I mean,
yeah,
I just
rage and yes,
but I was so quick to reject people.
Oh and, yeah,
you know, yes. So it, yeah, it's
anytime
a fascinating,
got too close.
It's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, anybody who got too close, I was like, no, that's no.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted. Like it was, so God, it was such a mess. Yeah. I recommend that book. I'll link to that in the show notes too, y'all. I mean, I think it's definitely one of those books where you take what you want and leave the rest. She talks about love avoidance as well. Yeah. And just the cycle. And she talks a lot about codependence as well. So it's a good one to have, but I'm also curious, and I'm sure the people are too. So what do you do now to stay sober?
Yeah. What don't I do to stay sober?
Yeah, right?
Truly, my whole life is not in like an oppressive way. It's just all in service of me staying sober because it is the most important thing to me.
Let me start here because I'm also really curious. Like, what did you do that didn't work?
Oh, okay. Well, this is fun. I did thinking that I could do it my own way, that I was such a special flower and so much more intelligent / unique / I mean, you name it. My head worked myself out of sobriety time and time again. I never tried to moderate. That's one thing that I just don't get. The only way I tried to moderate was by doing drugs.
Okay, yeah.
I never was like, oh, I'll just drink, you know, on this day of the week, or I'll just drink this many. That was hell to me from the beginning. I never wanted to do that. So I never tried to do that. I tried AA. I tried 12-step meetings, and then I tried not doing that. And I am a person that has gotten a lot from like 12 steps. And it also wasn't enough for me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't buy it wholesale and just do that. So those are the things that I did. I mean, there's probably more stuff. I tried everything. I mean, I tried to not know it. I tried to think myself out of it. I tried to put it off. I mean, that was one of the big things, is I just always thought it would be better to do it later. I thought there would be a date when it would be easier or more appealing, or that it would stick. So I tried, you know, all those things. And the things that I do to stay sober are, I do a lot of physical exercise and work, like being an embodied person.
Mm-hmm. One of those, like, that helps you.
How?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so a few things. And this is something I'm like deeply, deeply interested in, has become a big part of my work. But one piece is, I think just from a purely physiological standpoint, we know that exercise releases endorphins and dopamine and creates a lot of the same effects as what we're trying to achieve when we do drugs or alcohol. But it's like, there's no hangover from that. You know, there's no side effect. So I have always been an athlete, and I've always been someone who has liked exercising. I'm one of those lucky, annoying people. So I had that in my life, and I knew that I felt good when I did it. So there, from a physiological standpoint, like stress relief and creating those like good chemicals in my brain. But there's also a bigger thing, and this is why I have practiced yoga, although I didn't know this is why I was doing it, and why I have really like deepened my practice over the past 10 years, is I think Nikki Myers says this, and I think it's absolutely true, that our issues live in our tissues. And all the trauma, and trauma is one of those words that, you know, a lot of people think of trauma as like shock trauma, you know, getting abused or getting raped or getting, you know, PTSD. Mm-hmm. But trauma is really anything that exceeds your capacity to cope. This is Sean Corn, but it's perfect saying it leaves you feeling helpless, hopeless, or out of control. So we experience stuff like that every day, right? And when we experience trauma and we have a reaction in our body, and it gets stored in our tissue, and our body remembers that. So all of the experiences of my life as a woman, as a, you know, as a mother, as a married person, as a, you know, all of the experiences we accumulate over the course of our life, all of the shame experiences from my drinking, all of the everything, I do believe our body keeps the score. And I think unless we release that in some way, unless we discharge that energy, it stays in us. And for me, and I know you know this, but I I feel like it's so useful to people that don't know it, because it didn't really occur to me. It's like, why am I so attracted to this practice of yoga? Why do I feel better? Not just better, but why do I feel like closer to God for me? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel more connected to myself? Why do I feel like I just met myself again by doing this physical practice? I don't understand. And I think that's why. And I don't think it has to be yoga. It's the best thing I know of, but I think it has to be anything that gets you out of your head and into your body. Mm-hmm. I think so much of my recovery and the practices I do that support my recovery get me out of my head.
Right.
And, you know, I also do therapy, which is very much in the head type work. I think we have to address all of it, though. I stay connected to people in recovery. I mean, so much of my work is in this world, so I feel like I talk about it and kind of live and breathe it every day. But I, you know, I have sponsors. I also have lots of friends. I talk about this stuff all the time, and not to the point, like, I would have thought, you know, the me of 3 years ago would have thought that I don't want to sit there and talk about being sober or being in recovery all the time. I don't want that to be my life, but that's not my life. It really isn't. Like, my life is big and beautiful and exciting and wonderful. And I'm free to do all these things just because I take care of that. Those are some of the things I do. I mean, really, it's kind of everything. I sleep. I take care of myself. I'm like nice to myself. I mean,
who knew basic that things, worked?
Like sleeping. I right. sleep now. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Try to eat good things. I also don't beat myself up.
Yeah. Well, that one right there. I mean, we could have a whole podcast episode just on that. I talk about that a lot.
I know. That's kind of one of your jams, which is so important.
Yeah. Just the whole self-compassion is, and I don't use this term unless I really, really mean it, but self-compassion has changed my life.
It has. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. And compassion can be one of those squishy words that we, you know, sounds like a Hallmark greeting or something, but it's so not. So Pema Chodron does this amazing talk on compassion. It's the most beautiful thing.
It is. I know it is. I like that term. It's a squishy word. It really is. And I grew up in a house. I mean, God love my mom. And my mom she's a very strong woman and tough. And I grew up watching a legacy of women who would not take shit from anyone and just were strong women. And mm-hmm. Now in hindsight, I realize there's a lot of pain and things that are really going on. But I think that I grew up in a house where vulnerability and compassion did not exist. They didn't exist. Like, you get up, you brush yourself off, and you soldier on. We don't have time to feel sorry for you.
Right.
Not at all.
And there's like a value in some of that.
There is a little bit. Yeah.
But it's imbalanced.
For me, it bred perfectionism and it bred extremely high expectations on myself and of others. I have to watch out with my expectations of my husband more so. Poor guy. He's very patient with me. And it can breed self-loathing and it breeds a lot of shame.
For sure.
And I just want to say something really quickly too about shame, like while we're on the topic. And I've said this a few times in my podcast, but it's worth repeating because people hear that word. I have found having many conversations with women about it is sometimes they dismiss it because they think that that's not me. Like, I don't walk around feeling shame. Mm-hmm. And I think that what is actually happening is that we are running from it. We know what it's like and we know what it feels like because we've had moments of it. We all have. It's part of the human experience, but we are building a life where we're trying to run from it. So if you've ever participated in perfectionism, if you've ever participated in people pleasing or seeking approval, if you've ever participated in numbing, you are running from shame, girl. Mm. And I just wanted to point that out because there's a misconception.
So good. So true. It's like kind of like I was saying with trauma. Like everyone experiences trauma. Mm-hmm. It's not just for like the bottom experiences that we think of. Shame, I agree. Shame is like, we don't want it.
No.
You know, we don't want to admit that we have shame or that we're jealous or that any of the dark side stuff, any of the shadow stuff. But it is to the degree that we deny that in ourselves, we suffer.
Yeah. And I think that was where a lot of my drinking stemmed from too. You know, it's like I didn't want to let any of that in. Like, I was embarrassed and ashamed that I had these darker sides, and the way that that manifested was in gossip, that was in backstabbing, ending up feeling like shit because that wasn't authentically who I was, but I didn't know how to be. It was like, you know, that self-preservation of only the strong survive.
Sister, only the strong. Yeah, I know. I think that that's, you know, that is why you're doing this work. I'm sure you always see the beauty in that, you know?
Yeah, in hindsight, for sure.
Hindsight, going through it,
going through it and wiping
puke off your walls. Right. You know, sit there and go, I know this is going to be a beautiful experience
someday
that I will that will cause me to feel much gratitude later.
All right, so before we wrap up, and would you mind telling us one thing you're really proud of right now and one thing that you're struggling with?
Yeah, I'm really proud that I'm coming up on 2 years sober. And I'm really, really proud that I have stayed willing to stay with myself. Like, I've stayed with myself. I haven't abandoned me for a really long time. What I mean by that is, like, I've seen so much really rough stuff come up as a result of just being sober and awake. Mm-hmm. And I have been willing to, through the help of other people, like, I did not do this on my own. And I never do, to stay with myself. Like, that just feels so good. That is not where I lived for so long. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to leave, and I did leave, and that's okay too. But I'm really proud that I stay with myself. And what that looks like is I'm a better mom. I'm a better friend. You know, I have a shot at being compassionate towards other people. I feel really good about that. I mean, it has sort of been everything. Like, it has allowed the universe to unfold in a way that I could have never imagined for me. I quit my job and I started on this whole new path. And I think that all comes from staying with myself. And by myself, I mean the truest part of myself. Like, I mean, like, the God part of myself.
Yeah.
And trusting that. So I would say that the thing that I'm struggling with, I mean, I'm writing a memoir. So
you are?
Yes.
So glad to hear that. You're such a beautiful writer.
Thank you. So I'm struggling with that. It's hard, man. I remember reading when Cheryl Strayed said in some interview, she took like 3 weeks off from her life basically to finish her first draft of Wild. She went away from her kids and she said, I went away to do this thing. And, you know, I finished it, but it nearly killed me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, really? Like, how hard could it?
Oh my God, a memoir? Like,
I get it being hard, and I write about my own stuff all the time, but I really almost killed you, and I'm now understanding what that means. Like, parts of me are having to die.
Oh my gosh. I can't wait to hear the end, like, your synopsis of how it went emotionally.
Yeah, me too, because that will mean I have done it. Whatever it ends up being, it will be something that's behind me. So that's what I'm struggling with. It's a beautiful struggle, but it is a big struggle. You know, I'm banking a lot on not the success of doing this, but on sort of this new life that I've created for myself. And so it's kind of all of our trust and all of our doubts and insecurities that we get wrapped up into all of our, I mean, I'm not the most disciplined person. I'm not any of that. And so it's all like, I get to see all my shit come through in this process. So.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, my dear. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To you all day.
Thanks for going longer. I can't have a short conversation.
I know. I've trained myself to have them, having, you know, 100 and something episodes over.
I know.
I'm just so glad. I'm just grateful for this conversation and getting to talk to you about something that matters so much, and for you to tell your stories to help other people. And I'm just honored that you're willing to share it with my audience. And I will link up to where you are on the internet. I know that you do retreats, and I will link up to the podcast that you have with Holly. And if you guys are dying to know right now, if you go to lauramccowan.com and follow her on Instagram, definitely. You're one of my favorite people to follow on Instagram.
Oh, thanks. And you too.
Thank you all for being here. I'm just in a feeling very, very warm and
me
and
too.
And grateful.
I wish we could hug, but we can't.
I know.
Damn, one day we'll meet sooner rather than later in real life.
Okay, everyone. Thank you again so much for being here. And until next time, I will see you out in cyberspace. Bye-bye.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.